Hey, y'all, I'm Maddie.
And I'm Poodle.
And together, we host the podcast Reality Gaze.
We are two ridiculous homosexuals who love nothing more than talking about reality television
and tearing in a new one.
So whether it's 90 Day Fiancé, Love is Blind, Love After Lockup, or any other trash TV show about lonely hearts looking for love, your gay besties got you covered, y'all.
New shows every week. Follow and listen to Reality Gaze wherever you get your podcast. Reality
Gaze, let's love!
Welcome to On Deadline, your radio news from Odyssey newsrooms across the country. I'm Christy Strausser, Odyssey's managing editor of news. Let's talk about pests. And by that, we don't mean door knockers trying to get you to sign petitions. We mean insects, bugs, flies. Some are an annoyance and others are more than that. Some of them are dangerous. We'll start with the innocuous fish flies and move to the dangerous screw worms. Here's WWJ in Detroit.
Luke Sloan joining us from Lake St. Clair. You know, the one thing that many people comment on is their smell, Luke. And
yeah.
Do you notice that when you're there?
You know, I have noticed that this morning, Jackie. They're a bit stinky. We're talking about the fish flies, of course. And, you know, there's a lot of them these days. The people that I'm talking to here in St. Clair Shores this morning say it's really been since probably Sunday or Monday since they've really picked up. And all of a sudden you see fish flies like I see them right now on the sidewalk in front of me and on cars like what happened earlier today, plus on buildings. And the homeowners hate them as well, especially the boaters and the anglers as well. They really get annoyed by these fish flies. But a lot of people just deal with them. Like Andy, who's lived here in St. Clair Shores at 11 and Harper for a very long time. He says it's just what comes with the month of June here on the east side. So I asked Andy to that end, what do you do to try to get rid of the fish flies?
Keep your lights off at night. They don't have mouths on them, so they're not going to bite you. And that little thing looks like it's a stinger at the end. It's flexible. You know, they're just a harmless little bug that comes up this time of year, every year.
Others are nostalgic about the fish flies who I talked to, saying that they actually like seeing them because it means that summertime here. And while they may be stinky and annoying and everywhere, the Michigan DNR says a lot of fish flies are actually a good thing because that means the more fish flies, the better the water quality is of Lake St. Clair. So I suppose that's some good news to pass along. Reporting live this morning in St. Clair Shores, Luke Sloan, WWJ News Radio 950.
Here's more on screw worms with Bob Rose in Florida.
Let's have a conversation with Florida Ag Commissioner Wilton Simpson. Good morning, Commish. How you doing?
Good morning. I'm doing great.
Hey, I'm worried about this screw worm. You were the first to talk about it quite some time ago. I heard there are threats to maybe some cattle in the southwest United States. What's the latest and what are we doing about it in Florida?
Sure. Very good. Unfortunately, we do have to talk about this, Bob. But so the screw worm's a parasite. It will eat, it embeds in sores or infected areas and grows and then eats the flesh or eats, you know, what it's in. So we have to protect our food supply chain, number one, from the screw worm. And it is in Texas today. There's been several cases detected in cases. So what we're doing in Florida is we put a moratorium on any animals coming out of that area that's infected in Texas. I believe we extended that till Friday now. So we're getting prepared to do the proper inspections. We also require them to have veterinarians' certificates of treatment if you're coming out of the infected area. But the biggest threat that we probably have today in Florida is people moving their pets around. So if you are coming from an infested area and you have a pet, you certainly want to make sure that you want to check your pets every day anyways. Right now today, we don't have the screw worm in Florida. It's in Texas. But if you're traveling any, you want to make sure that, especially in the Texas area, that southwest area, New Mexico area, that you are checking your pets because obviously the screw worm can, we could get an infestation from pet owners bringing it back into Florida. And if you think you see a screw worm, if your pet has any type of injury, any type of open wound, you certainly want to monitor that very closely. If you see any type of activity with maggots or anything, you certainly want to get your pet to the veterinarian. There's plenty of treatments, so the veterinarians are well-equipped to handle the screw worm. And what we're doing in the state of Florida is we're going to be training additional staff and teams not only to do a more thorough inspection at our interdiction stations, but we're also going to be visiting areas where slaughterhouses and things where animals can come from Texas to our Florida slaughterhouses. We want to make sure that there are no screwworm coming in the state of Florida. And so we're going to do everything we can to keep it out of here. It's really an all hands on deck, though. And if you suspect you see anything that looks like that, then please contact your local veterinarian. And obviously, or you can contact our Department of Agriculture, let us know. We certainly would send someone out, but your local veterinarian will be able to treat your pets. And obviously, animal veterinarians are on alert already, and we're continuously updating them on progress.
So here in the Sunshine State, already, you know, experiencing drought, even though we've gotten some rainfall, it's still going to be problematic moving forward. As we talk about data centers and their use of water, I know you're not, you know, water management has their own districts and they have to deal with some of these issues. But if you're draining the Florida aquifer, that sure is going to affect agriculture. What's your take on these data centers? And is there any plan agriculturally to try to make sure the water supply is sustained?
Well, I'm glad you asked that question, Bob, because you're right. We do not really, we don't oversee any of these things, but we have very strong opinions. Number one, today in the state of Florida, there will be 1 billion gallons of water put to tide, reclaimed water. We should, in the state of Florida, now they did, there was a law passed this year, and the governor did sign it, directing some of these things to happen, like working with your water management on water and locations and things of that nature. What I would do, and we would look at this for next year in the farm bill, perhaps even, would be to say, number one, if you have a data center in Florida, if there's going to be one approved, it should have to only use reclaimed water only. That's number one. So it would take no water out of the aquifer at all, zero. Number two, they should have to generate all of their own electricity. So if you're a data center and you're coming into anywhere in the state of Florida that's approved, you should have to have your own plant, and then we will buy back any excess power that you generate at the wholesale level, which means it would be adding electricity to the grid, not taking any off of the grid. That's a very important point, because that way it would not only not burden any of our citizens, but it would certainly be then helpful, because it should reduce costs around the state. And number three, the data center should not be built in agriculture areas. They should be built in industrial parks. We have zoning for industrial parks, you know, by the counties. They should be placed in industrial parks. They should use reclaimed water only. And so I that at a minimum would be minimal criteria that I would look for before starting this. And again, if you put them where they belong, industrial parks, you make them use reclaimed water. And these are the most profitable companies that would be bringing these in here anywhere in the world. So if they have to spend, you know, tens of millions of dollars for infrastructure, they can certainly afford to do that, you know, for these centers. And so those are some of the kind of things I've thought about. Clearly, I'm not in the legislature. This is not something that we really have input on at a level other than having relationships with legislature. And it's local governments that would local governments, just as they approve, you know, growth and zoning and everything else, they would have to approve these centers. But if I were a local government, those are the three things I would be looking for to make sure that they were in compliance with.
And that sounds extremely common sense and logical to me. You mentioned the grid. Are we already decommissioning solar farm sites? Where are we at on that?
You know, I'm glad that's another good one, Bob. And we've posted some things on this. What a lot of folks on this, so we all get up in arms because a lot of these solar farms were popping up around the state. And initially, you know, you want them to go green, and you wanted green energy and, you know, renewable energy and the sun. We have a lot of sun in the state of Florida. So it's something that was looked upon favorably a couple of decades ago and coming forward. But then what happened was they started buying up massive amounts of farmland to put them on, not, you know, reclaimed land, not industrial park type areas, not in areas that would be a little more suitable for them. And so what we did in the farm bill 2 years ago, we said that if you are a solar farm that was on agricultural land, when you decommission it, and they generally, just like any other plant, they will run them for 30 years, and then they'll decommission that facility and surplus that land. Normally they would surplus that land to developers, and of course you could have anything there, right? It could be industrial, it could be housing, apartments, hooked, whatever. It could be, you know, that type of growth. What we've said in the Farm Bill was, is when you decommission those facilities, obviously you have to put it back to its natural state, number one. Number two, the Department of Agriculture has first right of refusal. We would purchase that property, and then we will remove the development rights off the property and then surplus it back into farming families' hands. And so everywhere you see these solar farms today, and the first one was built in Florida in 2009, so we backdated it to 2009 to cover the first one that was put in Florida. And so in the year 2039 would probably be our first test case where once it's decommissioned, once the panels are removed, some folks will say, well, what about any damage to the property that the solar panels have done? It's no different than any other facility that's built on our properties. Obviously, there would have to be an environmental study, a phase one, a phase two, perhaps, to see if there was any contamination anywhere. There would be, my guesstimation is there'd be very little or no contamination. That's things that they have to maintain and do as they go. But that being said, that land will be restored. So everywhere you see solar farms today, instead of housing, by the way, because they're developed to a solar farm, you know, they didn't get developed in housing. Once they're developed in housing, very rarely do you ever see that land return back to agriculture, right? Because those houses stay there forever. But where you see solar today, starting as they start decommissioning them, you will see agriculture again, not houses and other developments that would typically happen. And we put that in the Farm Bill 2 years ago.
I love that idea, and I love how you have this, you know, vision for the future of Florida and keeping it green and keeping it very ag-friendly.
Switching gears, agriculture is a business, and it turns out business owners aren't feeling super optimistic right now. Here's Tommy Tucker in New Orleans.
Hey, it's Jen Hatmaker. Here's what I've learned in midlife. Joy isn't the reward you earn after all the work is done. Joy is the work. That's what this new series on For the Love is all about. The sacred, yes. It's choosing delight, rest, and pleasure on purpose. Because saying yes to yourself, that's the thing that finally lets you fill your table with everybody else. Come find your sacred yes with me. Follow and listen to For the Love wherever you get your podcasts.
Leah Long joins us, director of the Louisiana chapter of the National Federation of Independent Businesses. Talk about small business optimism fell while uncertainty rose last month. What's behind that news? Good morning, Leah. How are you?
Good morning. Thanks for having me on today.
Tell me about the Small Business Optimism Index. What is that?
Yeah, so we do it every month to kind of report on how small business owners are feeling. And unfortunately, it did fall this month. And, you know, higher fuel prices are affecting a lot of that optimism. You know, the cost of supplies and deliveries has definitely went up. So the small business owners are feeling that. But also we're having labor and workforce issues. 29% of small businesses reported last month that they had job openings they couldn't fill. And so that's definitely a problematic issue for these small business owners.
Any reason why they can't fill those job openings?
It has to do with a lot of the just skill set of the workforce, which the Louisiana session just wrapped up last week on the 1st. I think that was last week. It all kind of time kind of flies by when you're in session. But it was the 1st, and there was a lot of focus on workforce. And I'm super proud of House Bill 549, which was by Stephanie Brart. It's the Bayou Works program. So it's going to allow grants for employers to kind of send their employees to get different skill sets, you know, whether you're in the construction industry, some sort of trade industry, plumbing, welding, whatever it may be, be able to connect employers and employees. Kind of goes back to the one door policy last year that she passed, and hopefully gearing up our Louisianans for a good workforce skill set opportunity.
You mentioned plumbing and welding. Is there one field that is hurting more than the other when it comes to employees?
Not necessarily, you know, it kind of is very diverse, you know, whether you have transportation, construction, but even when we get into the transportation industry, we talk about commercial insurance rates and they're super sky high. So that's one thing I was kind of sad to see that they didn't do during session this year was address the commercial insurance rates. So truckers are really struggling here in Louisiana.
Tell me a little bit more about the Bayou Works program, if you would, please, for people that don't know.
Yeah, so it just passed. It's an opportunity, so employers will be able to get grants. It'll go through the Workforce Commission, so there'll be information put out on this, you know, as they roll it out. And so if you have, you know, someone that's coming into your business and they want some sort of trade certificate, whatever it may be, or opportunity to connect to find people to have that kind of skill set, they'll be able to use this program, Bayou Works, through the Workforce Commission to be able to connect people for jobs.
How do supply chain issues affect, or how are they affecting small business owners?
Definitely. I mean, the cost of everything has went up. And, you know, with the cost of fuel, we talked about that a little bit earlier, is just, it is affecting the supply issue. You know, being able to get that, they're going to have to eat those costs, whether it costs more to get that, you know, whether they turn around and eat that cost or they pass it on to consumers. So it definitely is affecting everyday business.
So it's got to be hard with a lot of different variables to plan for the future, right?
Absolutely. And that is, unfortunately, as a small business owner, you're kind of hit with everything. And, you know, that owner is the one dealing with payroll, dealing with supply issue changes, whatever it may be. So it does affect their optimism, which last year, the 20% small business deduction was made permanent on the federal level. And that definitely increased optimism and for planning purposes. But now, you know, we kind of move forward. Here we are just been towards summer, and there's some issues that these small business owners are facing. So they're halfway through their year, and it's kind of concerning.
And for people that don't know about that small business deduction, explain what that is. Would you, Leah, please?
Yeah, so it was set to expire last year. And so the President Trump, along with the congressman, they definitely made it permanent. So we worked really hard at NFIB on a federal level. And so it was set to expire. It was a 20% small business deduction for pass-through entities. So if that wouldn't have been made permanent, these small business owners would have been hit with a 20% tax increase. And so that could have taken out the small business owner.
Those that don't know what a pass-through entity is?
Yeah, so it's LLC, so you file as, you know, your personal tax and personal income tax rate. So whether you're LLC, S-Corp, whatever it may be, so most small businesses usually operate under the LLC.
Somebody texted in and said, own a candle and T-shirt shop. People just don't have the disposable income. Sales are down 25% to 30% over the last 2 years. Has inflation affected the small business owner?
Yeah, absolutely. Inflation, it affects everyday people. So it's affecting, you know, how they spend their money. And it's unfortunate. Retail stores like that, you know, especially products like that, it is unfortunate. But I like to remind people, if you're going to go buy something, go buy it at a small business. You know, they are the backbone of the economy. That small business owner is probably fighting to keep their doors open. And so if you're going to go need to buy a candle, a T-shirt, whatever it may be, go support your local business. That money stays in your community.
In more rounds of job cuts in the Bay Area, a California WARN notice shows Salesforce is laying off 86 employees based in the Salesforce Tower in San Francisco. Study application Quizlet also says it's laying off 79 San Francisco-based workers. Life sciences company Verily reports 58 job cuts in San Bruno within business and software engineering sectors. And a state filing shows Morgan Advanced Ceramics is laying off 96 employees in Hayward. A new San Francisco bakery is walking away with one of the city's top pastry prizes. As KCBS's David Welch reports, Parachute Bakery just won the Best Croissant San Francisco competition.
The Best Croissant competition, now in its eighth year, draws finalists from across the Bay Area. Parachute opened in the Ferry Building last fall and wasn't expecting to compete. Co-owner and executive pastry chef Nasir Amar says they got the call just days out.
We were 11th on the list. We are not in the top 10, so one of the top 10 bakeries decided to opt out for their own personal reasons, and we got snuck in 5 days before the competition. So we had a very short window to prepare for this.
The short window was just the latest test. Amar spent months before opening pulling 36-hour days, testing flours, butters, fermentation times in his quest for the perfect croissant. 8 months later, all that work speaks for itself.
The recipe improvement that has gone in the last 8 months, every single day trying to be better than we were yesterday, it's been a lot of work, blood, sweat, and tears, and I think it is finally paying off.
In San Francisco, David Welch, KCBS.
World Cup excitement is here, and local groups are trying to capitalize on that, so there's still a benefit once the games are over. KCBS's Atta Shaheen reports from Oakland, where schools are reaping some benefit.
The Bay Area Host Committee is a nonprofit that was instrumental in securing the 6 World Cup matches that'll be played in Santa Clara, and now they're trying to make sure the World Cup leaves communities better off once the hype dies down. Committee President Zaylene John Muhammad.
My hope is that we do things like this whether or not there's an event coming into market. I think the event helps drive a lot of awareness, you know, and for an entity that looks to raise dollars privately, you need that awareness.
Tuesday, kids from Oakland Genesis,
a college and career pathway program masquerading as a free soccer club,
came out to United for Success and Life Academy Public School campus in Fruitvale to practice drills on the brand new pitch. Oakland Genesis has a wait list of 250 kids, and its director told me they have enough staff and enough funding, but not enough spaces.
This is beautiful turf, and we know these kids are going to love it for a long time.
Frontier Airlines making a comeback to Oakland San Francisco Bay Airport after 3 years. Frontier is kicking off nonstop service to Las Vegas in August with daily round trips. The budget airline's return to OAK comes after now-defunct low-cost Spirit Airlines pulled out of the airport in October of 2025. Spirit ceased operations last month.
So that's the bad business news. But how about the good? Here's more on Apple's AI upgrades.
Today, we are joined by Bloomberg's Nick Turner with more about some new child safety features unveiled at Apple's Worldwide Developers Conference on Monday. And Nick, what's included in this new suite of parental controls?
Yeah, so of course, Apple already had some parental controls, or quite a few. This kind of adds to that. It makes it a little easier to control what your kid sees in terms of websites, and also who they can contact. And also if images are sent, inappropriate things through FaceTime, it can sort of block them in real time to keep kids safe.
And the system can allow for only age-appropriate media to be accessible. How does that technology work?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that the parent is sort of controlling the process in terms of establishing, how old the kid is and setting up an account for them. So it's maybe a little different than some of the other sort of outside age verification systems and things like that. But theoretically, you set up an account for your kid and you set up the controls, and then it just sort of works in terms of preventing the kid from seeing inappropriate stuff.
How does a parent manage these settings? Is it pretty easy? How does that work?
I mean, I haven't gone in and tried the new settings yet. This is all pretty new. But I think, Apple's hallmark is certainly trying to make things as easy as possible. And I think that is the goal here. So I imagine it's going to be, and some of the things are set by default. So I think it should be a fairly simple process.
And is there a reason that they're unveiling these now? Was there any pressure, or is this consumer demand?
I think a little of both, but certainly there's been a steady drumbeat coming from a few directions on this. One is, regulators around the world potentially trying to rein in social media, especially make sure kids aren't using it below certain age thresholds, and certainly below 13. And I think that Apple has heard that and is trying to make sure they comply in their own way. Obviously, you're not a social media company in traditional sense, but they are kind of a gatekeeper of sorts for a lot of these things.
And we understand that FaceTime will now blur the screen when it detects nudity. So does this mean that the phone is constantly spying, and put that in quotes, on users?
Well, I mean, Apple basically tries to do these things on the device itself, which is preventing, ideally, data from going out into the cloud and your personal information being exposed. And I think that is the goal here. Personal privacy was a big theme of their big presentation this week. And I think that's sort of the way hopefully this will work.
And these new child safety features, is this an app, or does this come with a new operating system?
Well, yeah. So this week they unveiled all their new operating systems that won't be available to consumers immediately, but they will be by this fall. And that includes ones for the iPhone, for the Mac, for the iPad, for the watch, and so on. And so it was basically just a flurry of announcements about all the different things that are going to be available on these operating systems.
Of everything that came out yesterday, was there something that struck you more than others?
I mean, certainly there weren't necessarily a ton of surprises, because a lot of this information has sort of gotten out by now. But I think the new Siri, the new digital assistant, is really kind of the highlight of the show in terms of finally being able to have a conversation with Siri in a more natural way, and making it a little bit more like a chatbot, like an OpenAI, a ChatGPT or Claude. So I think that's the big breakthrough here. We still obviously need to see how it works in real life. So that'll be the next thing.
In your opinion, is it good enough at this point to get a new phone?
Yeah, I mean, that's the big question, right? I mean, I think the idea is to drive some kind of upgrade cycle. Now, we should note that some of these will be available on fairly recent phones, but not brand new phones. So if you have a phone from a year ago and maybe even 2 years ago, you still will be able to take advantage of this stuff. But if your phone is like, say, an iPhone 14 or an iPhone 13 or something earlier than that, then you're going to have to upgrade.
Thank you for listening to On Deadline, your radio news from Odyssey. On Deadline is written and produced by me, Christy Strasser, and by Lauren Barry. Subscribe wherever you get podcasts.
How We Made Your Mother is a rewatch podcast that looks back episode by episode at the hit TV show How I Met Your Mother. It's hosted by me, Josh Radner, along with series co-creator Craig Thomas.
In seasons 1 and 2, we were joined by Neil Patrick Harris, Kobe Smulders, Bryan Cranston, Ashley Williams, Wayne Brady, Jenna Fisher and Angela Kinsey, Joe Manganiello, and my brilliant co-creator Carter Bays. And now we are diving into season 3.
So whether it's your 50th rewatch or your first time through, follow How We Made Your Mother wherever you get your podcasts.